Dad's on the air. We're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
And this is Bill Cable coming to you today on Dads on the Air. And today we have a special program for you. We have a speech presented by Tim Winton on the occasion of the release of his new book, The Shepherd's Hut. Let's go with Tim.
I'm not what I was. All I am now is a fresh idea fanging north up the highway to where it's hot and safe and secret, with red dirt flashing by, mulga scrub, glinty stones, roadkill crows. The Jeep reeks from all them sloshing jerry cans in the back, but the windows are open and the wind is warm and the stink of petrol beats the smell of blood any day. All of a sudden I'm hungry. I get the shotgun by the neck, heave it over on the back seat. I shove the box of shells away to get at the food and it's still warm on the tin plate. It's good and greasy and tastes of smoke. From the first swallow I get a hot charge. And I drive like that, just under the limit, with a chop in one hand and the wheel in the other, laughing hard enough to choke. For the first time in my life, I know what I want, and I have what it takes to get me there. If you never experienced that, I feel sorry for you. But it wasn't always like this. I've been through fire to get here. I've seen things and done things and had shit done to me you couldn't barely credit. So be happy for me. And for fuck's sake, don't get in my way. I had to start somewhere, didn't I? Well, listen, thanks for coming. It was really kind of you to come. I would have felt like a bit of a knob standing here in Jeff's shed on my own. Before we get properly underway, I probably should apologise in advance for the slight sweariness of tonight's proceedings. I did try hard to keep myself nice, but I suspect that when I get home, Mum's going to wash me mouth out with soap. She'll be waiting at the airport with a stiff brush and a bottle of Handy Andy, I reckon. Although in the old days, Trousseau paste was her favourite. I think my teeth are still gritty from it. Anyway, sorry, Mum. But now that you're all here, and there's quite a lot of you, and now that I've had all the fire exits locked behind you to prevent escapes, because you've done your dough now, sorry, I'd like you to pause a moment, if you would, and settle. The way they used to make us settle for story time or rest time when we were in kindergarten. Remember that, in kindy? Sitting on the mat and everything? Well, I didn't bring the sock puppet, and I forgot to bring the recorder, so we'll just have to improvise. And you should be warned that this exercise could rapidly escalate to the point where you're holding hands with a stranger in the seat next to you. For the moment, though, I'd like you to think about yourself as a kid, the kid you were, how you thought, what your world was like, who you thought you were. And I was joking, by the way, the exits are not locked and this little group exercise doesn't involve special breathing or the holding of hands or, God forbid, any form of public singing or dancing. So you can relax. We might be in... This is the terror we don't get hysterical about in the media, around the water cooler. Doesn't get its own super department in federal cabinet. Nobody gets issued a black paramilitary uniform to combat this form of terror. Of course, I'm talking about the terror generated by toxic masculinity. In her recent book, Down Girl, and I can recommend it, and the only thing that could console me that day was the faint prospect that there might be somebody more miserable and cowardly than myself. And lucky for me, there was. Although it turned out to be someone called Ferdinand the Bull. Remember him? The teacher pulled me aside and distracted me with this lovely book about, of all things, a bovine pacifist. And look, he was all horns and beefcake, the old Ferdinand. But he just wanted to smell the flowers. And that was all right. He was still a bull. There's more than one way of being a bull. I think I probably should have paid a little more attention to Ferdinand a little later in my life, especially when I was an adolescent. Anyway, cast your mind back to childhood a moment if you can. Or if you prefer, maybe think about kids you know. Consider the scope and the shape of the world they live in. Not the great world of Putin and Trump and climate change, but the tiny contained world of childhood with its special logic, its urgent concerns. Now, when you're a kid, you think the narrow world you're from is the world entire. You can't be blamed for that because that's how it appears. It's how it feels. Most of your native world is made at home. Family is the prime force and first culture. And for some of us, too many of us, I guess, this original world remains the world entire. Some of us never leave it. Not just the physical environment, I'm talking proceedings. I did try hard to keep myself nice, but I suspect that when I get home, Mum's going to wash me mouth out with soap. She'll be waiting at the airport with a stiff brush and a bottle of Handy Andy, I reckon. Although in the old days, Trusol paste was her favourite. I think my teeth are still gritty from it. Anyway, sorry, Mum. But now that you're all here, and there's quite a lot of you, and now that I've had all the fire exits locked behind you to prevent escapes, because you've done your dough now, sorry, I'd like you to pause a moment, if you would, and settle the way they used to make us settle for story time or rest time when we were in kindergarten. Remember that, in kindy? Sitting on the mat and everything? Well, I didn't bring the sock puppet, and I forgot to bring the recorder, so we'll just have to improvise. And you should be warned that this exercise could rapidly escalate to the point where you're holding hands with a stranger in the seat next to you. For the moment, though, I'd like you to think about yourself as a kid, the kid you were, how you thought, what your world was like, who you thought you were. And I was joking, by the way, the exits are not locked and this little group exercise doesn't involve special breathing or the holding of hands or, God forbid, any form of public singing or dancing. So you can relax. We might be in Melbourne, but we are still in Australia. We do that stuff in kindergarten and then we spend the rest of our lives pretending we never did it at all. Actually, I can still remember my first day at kindy. I cried my eyes out. I clung to the chain link fence like a weeping Charles Bronson in Buckle Up Sandals as my mum drove away in a Morris Minor. And the only thing that could console me that day was the faint prospect that there might be somebody more miserable and cowardly than myself. And lucky for me, there was. Although it turned out to be someone called Ferdinand the Bull. Remember him? The teacher pulled me aside and distracted me with this lovely book about, of all things, a bovine pacifist. And look, he was all horns and beefcake, the old Ferdinand. But he just wanted to smell the flowers. And that was all right. He was still a bull. There's more than one way of being a bull. I think I probably should have paid a little more attention to Ferdinand a little later in my life, especially when I was an adolescent. Anyway, cast your mind back to childhood a moment if you can. Or if you prefer, maybe think about kids you know. Consider the scope and the shape of the world they live in. Not the great world of Putin and Trump and climate change, but the tiny contained world of childhood with its special logic, its urgent concerns. Now, when you're a kid, you think the narrow world you're from is the world entire. You can't be blamed for that because that's how it appears. It's how it feels. Most of your native world is made at home. Family is the prime force and first culture. And for some of us, too many of us, I guess, this original world remains the world entire. Some of us never leave it. Not just the physical environment, I'm talking about the mental field too, the world of ideas. And even in this era, when everyone's barking about disruption and mobility, there are still plenty of people unable to exceed their own origins. Not because they're weak or lazy, but because there are powerful forces arrayed against them, like class, race, geography, economics, and of course gender. All of them are forms of entrapment. They can be forms of impoverishment, forms of injustice and of violence. Matters that trouble me, as I'm sure they trouble you. But they're not things that I'm likely to change by writing a novel. Because a novel isn't a tool, it's a toy. And I'm reconciled to that. Art is about beauty. It creates a space for dreams, for empathy, for play, for mischief, for the posing of questions. And it needs no other excuse to defend its existence. The great mystery of art, though, is that it's both useless and yet somehow deeply necessary to a civilized life. And don't worry, I don't pretend to understand that either. But I am reconciled to it. And after nearly 40 years in this caper, I probably should be. As you can tell, I don't subscribe to an instrumental view of literature. I don't write stories to prosecute a case. But when I speak of a novel as a toy, don't get me wrong, I'm not belittling the form. It means too much to me. And besides, there's great embedded energy in a toy. Part of that energy is the sly power that comes from having no practical purpose, no workaday job to do. Like the song that was probably stuck in your head while you drove here tonight. Somehow it's the useless things that get their hooks in you. A tool, well, that's something you use with intent, something fit for purpose. Think of a hammer, axe, or a screwdriver. Usually its purpose is narrowly defined, and once the task is completed, that tool is just dead weight, just something else to trip over and curse if you're anything like me. But a toy, though, a toy is something you get to know out of curiosity, without much purpose or intention. Think of the yo-yo, the old slinky, the hula hoop, the spinner, or the ordinary cold and slightly creepy blob of Play-Doh. You come across it, you pick it up, delighted or skeptical, and you turn it over, you try it out, and you just try to figure out what it is. Not what it'll do so much as what it can be. And that initial curiosity can often lead to preoccupation or even obsession. The toy alters the space you're in. It takes you somewhere by occult means for reasons you can never quite explain. And you return to it, you try it again, you play with it differently. You take it with you wherever you go, just as you do with a song or a novel. Because for some reason, useless stuff resonates. The virtue of a tool is that it helps you accomplish something. All a toy can offer you is experience. And that's a matter of duration, depth, resonance. Your concrete tasks soon fall away, but your experiences, well, they linger to be absorbed as and internalized as memories. And they don't just enter your brain. We now know that experiences change our bodies. We even pass some on in our DNA. That's partly what I mean about the potency of useless beauty. That's why I read novels and why I write them. For immersion, for experiences, for resonance and depth, and mostly for useless beauty. But a novelist has to make beauty from squalor, from suffering. Because without trouble, without a problem, there's no story to tell. There's nothing at stake and nowhere to go. And so, somehow, I end up spending my days writing stuff like this. I headed for the shed, and then I stopped. And I don't know why, really. All I saw was his ute. And there was something funny about it, like it was way too high in the arse, like the tray was all angled up. And I thought, I'm not seeing right because of the swollen eye and stuff. Maybe that's why I didn't cop on straight away. Because the front wheels of the Hilux were fully off. Both of them was laying flat on the floor, one against the other. The nuts in a pile against the wheel brace. And the ute was casting a shadow that no light was ever going to make. A shadow doesn't search for a drain like that. Shadows don't have blowflies drowning in them. But I still didn't really know what I was looking at until I crept up past the driver's side door and peeped over the bonnet and saw his hairy legs and his bare feet stuck out from under the rhubarb. I dropped the skateboard and it scooted away and hit something with a clang. And then I saw the high lift jack slumped away from the vehicle. It was laying across rags and a tarry puddle on the cement. I saw tracks where some lizard run through the mess on his way out the door. I didn't even get down on my knees and check. Maybe I should have, to make sure and take some satisfaction from it. So I turned around and I walked out real careful. I went straight for the house up the side path. But I had to stop for a sec near the gas bottles. Yacked all over me vans. It was puke the colour of mustard it was. I just kicked them shoes off and kept going. The West Australian Wheat Belt is a battlefield, a war grave really. A place where two generations ago humans waged and won an epic war against nature. When vast woodlands were scraped away and torched to create broadacre paddocks on a scale that was and remains breathtaking. But now it's a strangely desolate region, stalked by rising salt and social despair. People have been leaving it for decades. Suicide rates, especially of young men, are three times higher than metropolitan levels. And this is where my story begins. That scene I read earlier about someone crushed beneath a car, you might be asking, what the hell's happening here? Who's telling us this? Well, fair enough. I wanted to know that myself when this grisly scene first elbowed its way into my consciousness. And it was weird because it arrived with all the heat of a memory while I was trying to write another book entirely, which is maddening. And so who's witnessing this scene? Who's telling this story? Whose voice is this? Well, it took some time to discover, I have to confess. Writing this book, The Shepherd's Hut, was a process of surrender. To get it right, I had to yield to the voice telling it and find out what I could as I went along. I'm flying off the ground, out of the dirt, and I'm no kind of beast anymore. So what does that make me? Someone you won't see coming, that's what. Someone you can't hardly imagine. Any of you's heard my voice now, you'd think it was weather or a bird screaming. You'd be sweating sand like I'm the end of the world. This voice just came with the imagery. It was the sound of someone alien and yet deeply familiar to me. A spiky, damaged, vainglorious, profane and opinionated adolescent. A boy who sounds at the very best like a bit of a handful. Put it this way, you'd think twice about giving him a lift or having him in your home. And if you passed him in the street, you'd be wary and alert. I think you know who I'm talking about. The prickly boy, the dirty boy, the smirking, smouldering boy you wish would just get on the bus and go away. The kind of boy you cross the street to avoid. The casually violent boy you fear that you have no power over. You may pity him a little in your progressive way, but mostly you despise him. You fear him. You want him gone. Well, he doesn't exist, this particular kid, my surly boy. He's a confection, a figment. All the same, I had him in my car and in my house and in my head for a couple of years. I'll tell you now, I'm not sure I'd recommend the experience because, yeah, he is a bit of a handful as a character, as a voice. So when I started writing this novel, I think I hedged my bets a bit because of that. Initially, I told the story from three or four different points of view because there are, of course, other people in the story. and because I thought this approach might throw different light on the central character. Well, that's what I told myself. What I was really doing was minimizing exposure to that voice, shielding the reader from the confronting unseemliness of his thoughts. Maybe it's my age or my having become comfortably middle class. Maybe it's the times we live in. The pressure you feel to keep yourself nice and your discourse blameless. Smooth and friction-free, that's how we like all our transactions and encounters now. Retail has trained us that way, hasn't it? It's infected our culture, our dreaming, so that in our storytelling we need virtue signalled at every opportunity. The likability of characters has to be dialed up to 11, and their safely secular redemption is a foregone conclusion. We expect closure like a money-back guarantee. And here I am caught with this grotty, foul-mouthed, racist urchin who's 50 shades of wrong for all those expectations. Thanks, mate. Anyhow, the fancy way, the multifocal creative writing way of telling this story, it just didn't work. And I saw in the end that I was just being a coward. So I relented and I went back to my unlovely boy and gave him the floor, so to speak. Wondering, of course, if in doing so I'd allowed myself to become his boy instead. And the jury is probably still out on that one. This kid never quite tells you how old he is, but you're pretty sure he's still a minor. He likes guns and knives and using his fists. He figures it's always best to get the first punch in. Don't let up till the other bloke's on the turf. And once he's down, sink the slipper for good measure. But he's not just a fighter. He's a lover too. Problem is, he loves his cousin, and passionately. And she's even younger than him. His name is Jaxie Clacton. He's got no siblings. He lives in a tiny town in the northern wheat belt of WA. One roadhouse, one pub, one silo. His mum died of cancer only a few months ago. He left school at 14, and now he's a butcher's apprentice to his old man, who's a terrible drunk and beats the crap out of him. Jaxie's body is covered in welts and scars and bruises. He's got a special secret name for his father. He calls him Captain Wankbag, or the Cap for short, when he's feeling affectionate. This is a bloke who's managed to gouge out his own eye with a fly swat, which I suppose does indicate a certain creative genius. Jaxie laughs at him. He despises him. But most of all, he fears him. In fact, he wishes he was dead. You can't really blame him. And so here's our boy this first night at the beginning of the book, standing in the shed, concussed, one eye swollen shut, taking in this grisly tableau. A scene, by the way, that came into my head one sunny day in paradise for reasons I'm not even going to guess at. The man under the car, of course, is Wankbag, and he's dead. Head crushed like a pig melon, as Jaxie has it. It's a horror to behold, and yet it's Jaxie's first glimpse of freedom. Freedom being, of course, just another word for nothing left to lose. Although Jaxie still has someone left to lose. I just went, he says. Got going, kept pushing. That's all I was for days, this moving, crazy thing. Pushing, hauling, going. And so begins Jaxie's flight, his long trek. He leaves home in the dark with only what he can carry. That's a high-powered rifle, some ammo, a bit of food and a few litres of water. At the outset, he's running from the cops. He's convinced they'll blame him for his old man's death. After all, everyone in town knows what Jaxie's suffered at his father's hands. But eventually, his journey takes on another dimension. Jaxie's walking out beyond the confines of his narrow world. Literally, as he crosses into the goldfields and the salt country towards the desert, but also imaginatively as he's forced to reflect on his life along the way. Jaxie thinks it's a getaway, but it turns out to be a little bit more complicated than that. Out there in the wild country, He has to be resourceful and self-reliant, and this does play to his strengths. He's got some bushcraft. He knows how to hunt and, of course, to butcher meat. He's got the whole male warrior thing down. He's courageous and stoical, and he's mentally tough too. He's determined to survive and to live on his own terms. And early on, Jaxie's machismo and his rather startling lack of empathy are a gift. But it's hard and lonely and brutal, this life of total solitude and macho self-reliance. In order to live, Jaxie's caught in an endless cycle of trekking and hunting and killing and butchering. It's a life drenched in blood and shit, a furtive existence of constant leaving and endless vigilance. He's desperate to be invisible, forever counting bullets and searching for water. And he's a rugged little unit, but the only way he can endure it all is to suppress all feeling, smother all residual empathy and shut off memory, to make himself, as he says, a thing. But that only gets him so far. Stuff gets past his armour, ideas and stuff. Stuff that's more scary than sleeping on the ground alone in the dark under the biggest skies on earth. In the end, he says, I stepped over the rocky ground between me and this old red roux and saw he was bled out and dead as a rock. But when I squatted down with the knife, I looked at his big brown eye and saw myself there, a reflection of me, a kind of shadow looming out of the sky. And I had this mad idea, like, there it is. Death. That's me. That's what I am. Jaxie comes to understand a little of what it is to be a human abroad in creation, the daily price of human survival, what that costs the self and what it costs the natural world. He's ambushed by the kind of realisation many of us cocooned in our bourgeois comforts and denials can shield ourselves from. In a way that the ordeal Jaxie's undergoing is just an extreme version of the home life and school life he's left behind. He's always lived in the world of things, of tools, of doing. He's used to being lonely and isolated, used to being scared and telling himself he's not. And he's been marinated in violence. He's internalised that. It lives almost like a virus in his body. His limbs, his face, his eyes, they all project it. He's always lived in a state of hypervigilance, fearing attack and offence at every turn. But attack and offence are within him. They're boiling in him. They're his prime instincts, ever present in his language, in his habits of mind. He trusts in actions. He's wary of talk and introspection. In many ways, Jaxie's a stunted creature. At times, given the stuff he thinks and says, he seems monstrous. But here's the thing. Like all children, Jaxie was born wild. But that doesn't explain his savagery. That's not congenital.
The day he came to the world in the usual way, but there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away, and he was talking for I knew it. And as he grew, he'd say, I'm gonna be like you, Dad. You know I'm gonna be like you. And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, I don't know when, but we'll get together then. You know we'll have a good time then. My son turned 10 just the other day. He said, thanks for the ball, Dad. Come on, let's play. Can you teach me to throw? I said, not today. I got a lot to do. He said, that's okay. And he walked away. But his smile never dimmed and said, I'm gonna be like him, yeah. yeah, you know I'm gonna be like him. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, Dad, I don't know when, but we'll get together then. You know we'll have a good time then. He came from college just the other day, so much like a man I just had to say, son, I'm proud of you, can you sit for a while? He shook his head and he said with a smile, what I'd really like, Dad, is to borrow the car keys. See you later, can I have them please? And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, son, I don't know when, together then, Dad, you know we'll have a good time then. I've long since retired, my son's moved away, I called him up just the other day. I said, I'd like to see you if you don't mind. He said, I'd love to, Dad, if I can find the time. You see, my new job's a hassle and the kids are the flu, but it's sure nice talking to you, Dad. It's been sure nice talking to you. And as I hung up the phone, it occurred to me he'd grown up just like me. My boy was just like me. Silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, son, I don't know when, but we'll get together then, Dad. We're gonna have a good time then.
And that's it for this week. We'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with us, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. So until next week, it's goodbye from Dad's on the Air.